All right, let's take our Bibles now and turn to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 22. Luke, chapter 22. We'll be looking today at verses 47 through 43. Luke 22, verses 47 through 53. Anyone who's had a decent education, any American who's had a decent education, knows the name Benedict Arnold. It rings in infamy with in our American history. He was actually accomplished in what we might call a great general who deserted his cause and attempted to betray the Continental Army into the hands of the English during our war for independence. It's a name that rings with disgust, because what he did was betray, and he was a traitor. And there's probably only one other name more disgusting and more well known as a betrayer and a traitor, and that is Judas. And we're going to see today his betrayal and the arrest of Christ in this paragraph of Luke 22, 47 through 53. And so we'll look at that, and then I want to, if I can, present the setting. Show you the characters in this event, follow the plot, the timeline, and then maybe draw out a few themes. I'm taking a literature approach to this, but it seemed like a good way to look at everything that's there. Verse 47 of Luke chapter 22 says, "And while he yet spoke, behold, a multitude, and he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them, and drew near unto Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said unto him, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? When they which were about him saw what would follow, they said unto him, Lord, shall we smite with the sword? And one of them smote the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. And Jesus answered and said, Suffer ye thus far. And he touched his ear and healed him. Then Jesus said unto the chief priest and captains of the temple and the elders which were come to him, Be come out as against a thief, with swords and staves. When I was daily with you in the temple, you stretched forth no hands against me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness." So we have here the event of Judas's betrayal and arrest. And let's just put it in time, just to kind of the time setting. This is, of course, the night before Christ died. But if we go back to earlier in the week, Jesus Christ presents himself as the Messiah and enters Jerusalem triumphantly. Multitudes there are praising him, crying out, "Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." And we have this, what we call a triumphal entry. And then he comes into the temple, looks around, and goes back to the Mount of Olives. He spends his nights in the Mount of Olives. And then the next day, he comes into Jerusalem, and he cleanses the temple. We remember that. He cleansed the temple very early in his ministry. And then here, right before the end of his ministry, he cleanses the temple. Now, cleansing the temple has kind of a benign sound to it. It wasn't like he got the broom out and was sweeping the dust out of the corners. The temple was a place of, was a racket. There was people exchanging money at exorbitant rates. There was people selling animals, temple animals that were, you know, because pretty much every animal you brought from the outside didn't measure up to the standards of temple animals. And so you could buy a temple animal. And of course, since there was, they were of such special quality, they costed a whole lot more than what they're really worth. And of course, you had to use temple money, and that's why they had money changers there. They had all of it. It was a racket. The high priest and the rulers of the people controlled this. They were got very rich off of on the backs of the people. Well, anyway, Jesus, that's what he cleansed. He drove them out of the temple. It was very just. Maybe I'm in a rambling mood. I hope not, hope we can get this in, Sam. We might have to come back to this passage next week. That'll blow my schedule, though. I've finally, we've gotten close to the end. So I've got a schedule to get to the end. It's vague the further out we get, but I think we're on schedule. I'm going to try. Pretty close. Hopefully we'll be done before then, though. We might have to bleed over just a little bit, especially if I keep up stuff like this. Anyway, just to point out, Jesus was a man. He's a very masculine man. If a man that could flip over tables. Now, those were not the Walmart plastic tables that we have around today. I mean, I don't know what they had for tables, but he overturned the tables. And I know they weren't light, whatever we're used to today. He made a scourge out of things. He drove the animals out. Have you seen what animals do when you scare them, when you rile them up? They don't just go wherever you want them to, okay? He did that. He was a man, a masculine man. Anyway, that has nothing to do with what we're saying. I'm just kind of bringing us up to here. So he drives, he cleanses the temple, and then probably teaches the people some that day. The next day is full of teaching from Christ in the temple. And all the questions, remember the questions from the Pharisees and the Herodians and the scribes and the lawyers and all the different questions. And then he questions them of some. And then as they leave the temple area that day, they go back to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus talks to the disciples about it gives what's called the Olivet Discourse, the Mount of Olives, the discourse from the Mount of Olives, where they're looking back at the temple, and he says how everything would be destroyed, not one stone upon another, and he tells about many things that will happen in the future, because they want to know when he will set up his kingdom, and so he kind of tells them, not now. We don't know when. It's coming, it will happen. But there's some things that will happen before that, all kinds. So he has that. And then Thursday of this week, we're kind of tonight, right here, it's nighttime. If we're using our type of thinking, it's probably Friday. It's probably after midnight. But somewhere in the middle of the night, is where we are here. So Thursday seems to be not a lot recorded about that. In the beginning of the day, his disciples come to him and say, where are we going to prepare the Passover? Because they know they have to prepare the Passover. And Jesus gives them vague instructions, vague to everyone else, but they turn out to send them specifically exactly the place that he had planned out. It's vague because the timing has to be right. Jesus knows that Judas has gone to collaborate with the high priest to betray him. He cannot, but there's a lot of things that still have to happen. So he makes sure that Judas and the high priest and all of them don't know where the Passover feast will be. It would be an ideal place to capture him because there won't be a lot of the crowds around there. But nobody knows where that is except him and, John and Peter. But John and Peter are busy doing what they're supposed to. Anyway, so they get there, and so that evening they celebrate the very last Passover, and Christ institutes his own supper. And then many things happen through that night. Almost everything that we read in John 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 happens up there in the upper room there. And they, in the course of that time, Jesus dismisses Judas. He leaves. The disciples think he's going to give something to the poor or buy something that they need. Jesus knows what he's going to do. And then they continue. And then as they leave the upper room in Jerusalem, they're in the city of Jerusalem somewhere. They make their way out of the eastern, people would think it's the eastern gate of Jerusalem. I don't know which gate it was, but it's out the eastern side, because we know he went down into the Kidron Valley, across the Kidron Creek there, or river, or whatever you want to call it. And just across that is a grove of olives, olive trees on the Mount of Olives, and a garden, the Garden of Gethsemane. He often went there. And so he goes there, and last week we read about how as he got there, he left eight of the disciples at the gate to the garden. He took Peter, James, and John in a little bit further and instructed all of them to watch and pray. And then he went a little bit further and went through the agony of the Garden of Gethsemane. When that is finally finished, he comes back to his disciples, and it seems evident that he's all the way back where all of them are there. And so Peter, James, and John are back with the other ones, and he's talking to them about their sleeping. And then, while he's talking to them, this crowd comes. So, in verse 47, it says, "While he yet spoke, behold, a multitude, and he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before him." Now, Judas, we've seen him a lot. He kind of gets not as much attention as Peter and James and John, but he gets a fair amount of attention because of what he does now. If he'd been like the rest of them, I'm sure the things he had done along the way wouldn't have showed up in the history. But he said something about how the box of alabaster ointment could have been sold, and John tells us, well, he said that because he's a thief and he had the bag, not because he cared about the poor. And a few other times we see things about him because we know the end of the story. But Judas also, he was a disciple, though. It wasn't like Jesus called him and he was the sore thumb for 3 years. If he was the sore thumb for 3 years, people would have expected this. They didn't expect it. He fit in right with all the rest of them. In fact, he fit in so well that he was very trusted. He was trusted with their money and these types of things. He was right in the middle of them, beside being trusted and not sticking out. He heard Jesus' teachings. He heard all the teachings that the multitudes heard. He heard all the teachings that the disciples themselves heard. He lived in constant contact with, or constant association with Christ for 3 years. There's no one had any closer relationship than Judas, except for Peter, James, and John. He was right in the middle of all that. And yet, this is what makes his deed so terrible. He's able to, even though living with Christ, his sin grabs him, grips him, takes him all the way to the point where he would betray the Lord Jesus Christ. So he is at the front of this crowd. So if we have we have Jesus and the disciples kind of at the gate or at the entrance to the Garden of Gethsemane, and there's a crowd that comes, a multitude, Luke calls it, that comes also from Jerusalem. And we don't have, it would be interesting if we did have the time to bring together everything that all the Gospels tell us about this, but we'll just bring in a few things. John tells us that they had torches. So this was something that was seen. They would have seen this multitude come. How many was in the multitude? There's some speculation about that, but Luke says multitude. It wasn't a dozen or a score of people. If we look later, it says, Jesus said unto the chief priests. So there was chief priests there. This is in verse 52. And the captains of the temple. The captains of the temple, or the temple guard, those are the people that kept order on the temple grounds. And those would be Jewish people, Israelites, who kept order on the temple grounds. And they're the ones with the staves. Jesus says, you come to me with sword and staves. They're the one with the staves. The Israelites, they weren't allowed to have swords. They were subject to the Romans, and they had staves. They could beat people up that got out of line on the temple grounds, and there would be hundreds of thousands of people there, so there was a large contingent there. But, so you have the chief priest, the captains of the temple, and their people with their staves, and the elders. This would be people that were rulers of the people in the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin was about 70 men, so some of them were there. So you have priests, captains of the temple, rulers of the people, the elders, and then we know that there were Romans there. There was a cohort of Romans there, and that's about a tenth of a legion. So that's, and you would think, we can assume that since it was Passover and the Romans knew there would be a lot of people there, their ranks would be full. Okay, because a legion was up to 6,000 soldiers. We would think that at this point, because it was a busy time, that a legion would be 6,000 soldiers. We're just making that assumption. Maybe it's 5,000. Either way, a tenth is what? 500 or 600 soldiers. So you have the temple guards, plus the Roman soldiers, plus these leaders. There's a multitude. It's not a small thing that happens. But this was a very busy, there was millions. Remember we said there was probably 2.2 to 2.5 million people in Jerusalem. So seeing 1,000 people going around on the night before the Passover, or the night of the Passover, would not be a strange thing necessarily. Okay, but it was a large number of people. It was a multitude. And as we said, okay, so you have Romans there. And if you just think about it, the Romans, they kind of care less. They're just doing whatever. Here's this, that, you know, their officer told them to go and catch this guy who's insurrectionist. There's the temple guard. They would be somewhat interested in this. There's the Sanhedrin, quite the rulers of the people, quite interested in this. And the chief priests, they were the ones whose pocketbook had just been messed up quite a bit. So the rulers of the people if Jesus continued, they would lose control of they would lose their place. And the chief priests were among those rulers of the people, and also they had already, if this continued, they would lose both their money and their place. So this is a large crowd of people coming from Jerusalem, coming from the city of Jerusalem down the side of the mountain that Jerusalem is built on, across the river, through the valley, and up into the Garden of Gethsemane, which seems that the Garden of Gethsemane is not very far up on the Mount of Olives, so not far across the river, or the brook Kidron. Then, of course, there's the disciples there, and as we said, they are just being roused from their sleep. Jesus had come back to Peter and James and John and woke them up and said, can't you pray with me, pray with me for an hour? Finally, when it was all finished, he comes back and he says, you might as well sleep now. Sleep on now. And by that, he meant he no longer needed their prayer support, because he had got the victory. He had overcome the temptation and the struggle and everything that was going on, how Satan was attacking him in Gethsemane, that was over. And we see from that point on, he is, not that he never was, but he's tremendously the master of every situation that he's in. He's right here, he is, from point to point, all the way through. It's very clear that he's in complete control of these situations. But so he comes back and says, sleep on now, and then in the middle of that he says, rise, don't want to be sleeping. There's a bunch of people with swords coming. You don't want to be sleeping on the ground. You need to get going. And really, he did that for their own protection, among other things. So there's the disciples here in this instance. And then, of course, there's Christ. And so there's two main characters. There's Judas and all of those that are behind him. And there's Christ and the disciples that are behind him. Now, I want us to think then about Judas's timeline. The last time we saw Judas was he was in the upper room. And Jesus sent him out, said, what thou doest, do quickly. And he did need to do it quickly. He wanted to just be done with this. For a while, he had decided that Jesus wasn't who he thought he was, but he was going to at least get something out of the wasted 3 years that he had done, the 3 years he had wasted of his life following this guy around, who wasn't going to be the king of anything. So he'd contracted, covenanted with the high priest to betray him, to turn him over so he could get some money. And now he knew for at least three or four nights, every night Jesus went into the Mount of Olives. So he knew where he was going to go tonight also. It was a place that he was often went to, and Judas knew that that's where he would be going when this was done. He had been foiled in any ideas that he might have had about turning him over at the Passover meal, but he knew that they would leave because that wasn't his house, and that night, just like every other night, he would go into the Mount of Olives. And so he left. And he got the high priest. What do you think that took? Do you think they were all just waiting in a room with all their bands of armies and all that? They weren't. That took a little bit of time. So Judas leaves. He finds one of them. I don't know. Maybe there was one that they had already decided that when you think you know what's going on, see, you know, whatever. We could think of a good Jewish name there. See him. But he found one. That one had to get the other priests, at least some of them, and say, okay, now's the time. They had to get, because there were chief priests there, they had to get the elders, the rulers of the people, some of the Sanhedrin together. This is nighttime. There wasn't, people were in their homes celebrating Passover. There wasn't a large contingent sitting around the temple. They had to gather the temple guard. Then they had to get the Romans. And you don't just, a little Jewish person doesn't just go say, hey, you guys, come with me. No, the Romans were the ones in control. They didn't do what just any Jewish man would come to them, even if he's a chief priest, and do what they said. They had to go to the leader of the Roman soldiers, and he had to go to his authority, which I don't know how many levels, but finally it would have had to get to Pilate because Pilate was there. Okay, and so he was the final authority there. So Pilate would have had to authorize, yes, and then they would have had to have this story. There's an insurrectionist. He's trying to cause rebellion. Would that be believable? That some guy who had hundreds of thousands of people following and shouting his name and all of that just 3 days before, could you convince somebody that he might turn those crowds against and cause, yes. Okay, so they use that, sure. And so then they finally get all these people together. They probably meet near the temple because the fortress of Antonia is right next to the temple, just a paved street between the temple and even connected. So you got the soldiers from there, the guard from the temple area, the others probably met there, and very likely left the same gate that Jesus and his disciples went, and they went down, okay, and they come into the garden. Now, Judas says, now, it would have been the time of the year, and the way they figured their months and all, it would have been a bright night, but the Mount of Olives, especially the Garden of Gethsemane, was full of olive trees. It would have been shady there. And so Judas says, "There, I will show you who it is. And this is how I will show you. I'm not going to say I'm not going to point to him. I'm not even going to just grab his hand. I'll show you with a kiss. Of course, kisses then and kisses now are a little different, but it's this kiss was a long embrace. If you think of maybe the way you see Eastern Europeans or foreigners give a kiss where they're touched cheeks or something like this, it'd be similar to that, but it was long. Mark tells us, the verb Mark uses is that he kept kissing him. Okay, so he went there, and as he comes to him, he embraces him and holds him long enough until the soldiers could get him. That way, there was no question about which one it would be. You can imagine how hardened you would have to be to use that close. If a student or a slave would kiss, you know, their master's hand, the inside of the hand, the outside of the hand, their feet, something like that, but not their. Judas assumes even a closeness and uses that to show who Christ is, so there's no mistaking who he is. As he does this, and the disciples figure out what's happening, one of them says, "Lord, shall we smite with a sword?" Now, how many swords did they have? Two. How many swords did they have? Well, the Jewish, they had swords and staves. You had a lot of people with clubs, and you had a lot of people with swords, a lot of Roman soldiers with swords. So it's kind of, it seems like, how in the world would they have gotten to the place where they think their two swords would do anything here? But if you recall the situation, what did I skip over that John tells us happened in this chronology? When the crowd came, Jesus steps out in front of his disciples and says, "Who are you looking for?" Remember? And they say, "Jesus, the Nazarene." And what does he say? He says, "I am," that's all he says. Our English supplies the "I am he." "I am." And what happens when he says those words, "I am"? All of them. And it's not just a crowd of 20 that fall on the ground. It's a multitude. All the Roman soldiers, they all fall on the ground. So you can imagine Peter, they're just going to fall on the ground. Should we take our swords after them? Possibly. There's some of the, I don't know that it would be that. We laugh at that, but there is a little bit of, you know, you'd think, how do they think that with two swords they could take these on? Well, all of them had just fallen on the ground. They gathered themselves back together, and Jesus says again to them, "Who are you looking for?" And of course, he says that so that they say who they're looking for. He says that so that these others could go, would be free, so that they wouldn't be arrested. He knew what his disciples could handle and what they couldn't handle, and he knew they couldn't handle being arrested. Well, so then what does Peter do? Peter, and it doesn't say Peter here, but we know it's Peter from the other accounts. Peter takes a whack at one of them that's toward the front. The chief priest's slave was there, or servant was there, takes a whack at him, goes for his neck, and gets his ear. Okay, most likely the guy, you know, sees the sword coming from him and ducks like this, and his ear gets taken instead of his neck. And in this instance, there's tremendous danger here. Tremendous danger. What could have happened? What could have happened? It could have been some of you have been in the military. I don't know if you've been in this type of situation where you were going to get somebody, but if you're going to arrest somebody and his buddies launch out at you, what are you going to do? You're going after them. This was going to be orderly, but it's not anymore. And if if war or a skirmish broke out, what most likely would have happened? Peter, all of them, probably they would have been killed. What would the result of that be? Is there anybody to, I mean, even if Jesus miraculously, because he's God, rescued himself from that, I suppose he could have just, you know, brought all of them back to life or something. But if the disciples were killed, there's no church. There's nobody to take on, to carry forward the message that of what happened to Christ. Very likely, Christ himself would have been killed. If we're thinking in human terms, he would have been killed. There's a problem with that. Now, he was to die, but not that way. The scriptures have to be fulfilled. And the scriptures tell us how he's going to be fulfilled. So, Jesus is tremendous calm, and he says something, and it's almost like, everybody stop. What he said basically had that effect. Okay, he got the disciples to stop, the mob and the soldiers stop. Everybody stop, suffer ye thus far. Everybody stop. He grabs the ear, puts it back on, whether it was dangling or it had fallen off, whatever. He fixes it. And then says, okay, take me, let these go. You don't have warrant for their arrest. They really don't have warrant for his arrest, but he's the one they're looking for. Take me, let these go. So, in this, a few things just to point out. First of all, a theme that we see recurring throughout the Bible, the sinfulness of man. Sinfulness of man. All the different people involved here. Judas is the most despicable. But you've got the priests. You've got the elders of the people. You have the temple guard. Even the Roman soldiers have culpability here, but they're just kind of careless. But there's people all across the world that are careless and culpable at the same time. So they have you've got the disciples with their weakness and their lack of preparation by prayer. They respond in the wrong way. So we have the sinfulness of man. And then I think we see the sovereignty of God. In the last verse, and I need to finish, but in the last verse it says, when I was daily with you in the temple, you stretched forth no hands against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. It says, this is your hour. This is the kind of the culmination of all the wickedness and evil of mankind. But how long is it? It's an hour. This is the time they have. This is the time Satan has got the most of his power. The power of darkness is there. This is your hour. But it's in that phrase is that I'm still in control. You have an hour. Do what you're going to do. After that, I'm doing what I want to do. Because he's God. And then, of course, through all that, we can't help but see the redemption of mankind. Christ's sacrifice of himself. Why? Why would the God of heaven, the creator of all these beings, allow himself to... Why would he allow Judas to be in his company for 3 years? Why would he allow all of these things to take place? Why would he put up with all of these things? Somebody said to fulfill Scripture, yes. But beyond that, why? Because mankind had fallen. And he was giving himself, all of that was part of him giving himself to die so that we could trust in his life, in his death, in his resurrection, in his sacrifice, and receive salvation from him. Without all this happening, without Christ doing this, all of us would be dead, would be hopeless. But through this, through him, we can have and have salvation. Let's pray. Our Father,